This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Stay tuned for a review of the week in WMRA news, including the kickoff of our special series called Women of Interest. And Sefe Imakpai profiles the new pastor at a Lutheran church in Charlottesville. We also recognize Jesse Nadler, Jordy Yeager, and Christopher Clymer Kurtz for the award they have received as part of last year's Refugees in Virginia series. The Virginia Association of Broadcasters took notice in its honors this year, so we'll listen to some excerpts from that fine reporting. But first, the majority of streams in the Chesapeake Bay watershed, that includes most rivers that flow through the Shenandoah Valley, are in some state of pollution. The first and best stop for cleanup is on agricultural land, but government assistance is woefully inadequate, and President Trump has proposed cutting off all of the EPA's Chesapeake Bay cleanup funds. WMRA's Jesse Nadler looks at the future of water quality in Virginia.
Bobby Whitescarver and his wife, Jean Trimble Hoffman's 40-acre farm in Swope, has been in her family for 9 generations. It's not hyperbole to say that farming is in her blood.
She's actually a cow whisperer. She knows cattle. I know grass. Some people would call this a grass farm, because that's where it starts.
The Middle River that flows through their farm is a tributary of the Chesapeake Bay. It is the biggest river in Augusta County, and it's also the most polluted. It's because upstream there are cows in the river.
So when it's hot, the cows want to be in the river to cool off. But they disturb the sediment. They destroy the stream banks.
Sediment suffocates fish and other aquatic life. The Middle River can no longer support Virginia's native brook trout, thanks to the cows upstream.
They deposit manure and urine in the water, and that pollutes it.
Manure contains E. coli. In addition to fencing, Whitescarver has spent years cultivating a dense wall of trees, bushes, and grasses lining the riverbanks. This riparian buffer keeps the water cool and helps prevent sediment, runoff, and other pollutants from reaching the water. He consistently tests the water for E. coli as it enters then leaves the farm. E. coli levels are typically reduced 30% by the time the water flows downstream. Riparian buffers are vital for improving the health of Virginia's waterways. The USDA has implemented programs to incentivize landowners to conserve more land. The biggest and most successful is the Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP, which pays rent to farmers like Whitescarver who take land out of production and convert it to cover. Since its inception, landowners around the country have enrolled more than 23.5 million acres of land into the program.
It's a very lucrative, I would say, or beneficial program, for farmers. In exchange, you manage that land to a conservation standard.
Al Todd is the executive director for the Alliance of the Chesapeake Bay. His organization works with landowners on planting buffers. CRP has proved to be very popular because landowners often make more money from CRP than what they'd earn from renting that land to, let's say, a rancher for grazing. It's become so popular that the program is now on hold because it's about to reach its congressional limit of 24 million acres. This is an issue because landowners have less incentive to conserve land. Raising the acreage cap was a big topic of discussion during a Senate Agricultural Committee hearing on conservation's role in the 2018 Farm Bill last month. And part of why it's so popular, says Al Todd, who used to work for the USDA, is that the CRP isn't selective enough.
It's kind of a first come, first serve. Everybody who meets the minimum qualifications qualifies. As we increase the cap, we might want to only increase the cap for a limited number of practices that produce, an exceptional number of benefits.
Such as planting riparian forest buffers to protect the watershed. Now, there are other conservation programs available to landowners in Virginia. There's the Resource Management Plan. There's CREP, which is a subsidiary of CRP. There's the Ag Best Management Practices Cost Share Program. But CRP is the flagship. It's the biggest and most prominent. And state funds for these other conservation programs are facing shortfalls, too. According to the Chesapeake Bay program, 900 miles of stream buffers need to be planted each year to reach cleanup targets of the Bay watershed. The pace as of 2015 was 64 miles per year. And that number will almost certainly decrease if President Trump's proposed budget goes through, which calls for zero funding of the EPA's Chesapeake Bay cleanup program.
That's going to affect us big time. The EPA's Chesapeake Bay Program helps fund state positions. It helps fund cost share programs to help pay for alternative watering systems, fences, hardwood native trees along these streams, the things that we're talking about right here. That budget zeroed out would greatly impact water quality. And we know this works. You can see it, 30% reduction. This farm produces clean water because of those programs.
Trump's proposed budget is unlikely to pass. It's more like a wish list, but it signals the administration's desire to turn conservation over to states. And the governors of the six states in the Bay watershed, not surprisingly, really want that full federal funding. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
Also this week, we kicked off a new series you'll be hearing over the next few months in which we will profile some women in our region with unique perspectives, new roles, or simply approaching life along the road less traveled. Like many other women, they are changing the lives of people around them in positive ways. We began this week in Charlottesville, where St. Mark Lutheran Church welcomed a new pastor in May. Victoria Parvin is only the second female pastor to serve the church, and as WMRA's Sefe Emakpai reports, her hope is that she won't be the last.
It's Sunday morning, and service is just beginning.
We speak of accepting, we speak of respecting.
Victoria Parvin is pastor here at St. Mark Lutheran.
This is a very open congregation, I would say. They are reconciling in Christ, they are openly saying that what holds us together is more powerful than what separates us.
What might separate Parvin from the average member of the congregation here is a lot. Born in the 70s in communist Hungary, Parvin's path to religion was neither easy nor conventional.
One of my grandmother would take me to church, especially at Christmas. We would sneak out and go to the local church at midnight. It was actually a midnight mass.
Parvin says though her grandmother was the first to introduce her to faith, it was her non-religious father who unwittingly led her to the church with a Bible.
My father had a lot of books, and I just happened to find it and read it. Something was very powerful about it, and I reached out and started to ask people about God. My parents would say, well, some people believe in God. And I would say, does God exist? And they would say, well, for some people.
Parvin soon became immersed in the church, participating in youth programs, church camps, and Sunday school. She called it an exciting time.
It was almost feeling like being rebellious by sneaking out and not telling to everyone that I'm going on Sunday morning to a Sunday school in the Catholic Church and in the Lutheran Church.
But simmering under the surface was a call to something greater.
It is a feeling of something different than you ever heard before or experienced before.
Parvin enrolled in seminary school and embarked on the path to becoming the pastor she is today.
I think the biggest step was just to finding a woman role model who would say to me, have you thought about being a pastor? It is just something that if you don't have a role model around you, you never even try to imagine it or come up with the idea yourself.
But the path, she says, wasn't always easy.
When I first time applied to the seminary in Hungary, Budapest, I remember they advertised in the school as "we prefer men." My bishop said to me, I'm not sure how long you would have to wait because congregations are not prepared, most of them, for female ministers. So they are asking me for male ministers. So what can I do? And that really made me realize, well, education is not enough. Having the call is not enough. There's more fights that had to be done.
And fight she would. Parvin would eventually land her first role as an intern at a church in upstate New York, followed by two congregations in southern Illinois. As the first female pastor there, she recalls the difficulty in her sense of isolation.
I felt really alone, and people would say, you don't look like a pastor, which I understood what they meant was I wasn't a man. I had to kind of push and prove myself. I used to wear my collar everywhere so that I would be identified.
Now in Charlottesville, Parvin is the second female pastor St. Mark Lutheran has seen.
I find her to be very dedicated, and her faith is very strong, and she has a good way of presenting her faith to others.
Congregation member and usher Tom Heckmanzik has been with the church for the better part of 17 years and praises Parvin for bringing her own unique set of gifts and skills to the table.
I think she's very inclusive. She wants to be a part of this community and make sure we stay involved and dedicated to the community as well as the church here itself.
Parvin says she hopes to set an example for the next generation of pastors, male and female alike, and views her role as a grand responsibility.
I see that is a very important opportunity. God is always surprising us with new things. And I see those struggles that we have, especially this time that we are separated, as not only challenges but opportunities to prove our faith and to show who we are.
For WMRA News, I'm Safiya Mokpai.
Support for WMRA's Women of Interest series comes from F&M Bank, a local independent community bank since 1908 with locations throughout the Shenandoah Valley, online at fmbankva.com.
Finally, you may remember another of WMRA's special news series, last year's Refugees in Virginia. I am proud to announce that that series has been recognized by the Virginia Association of Broadcasters as the Outstanding News Series of 2016. So let's listen back to some excerpts. Here's our first part. Even if high school was a great time for you, there were certainly times when you felt a little lost or left out. Imagine going to high school in another country with another language and another culture. Oh, and you may also be carrying trauma from some horrific things you witnessed in your home country. WMRA's Jesse Nadler has the story of one Harrisonburg high school program that pairs refugee students with others who have been there.
Guess what is the second most common foreign language behind Spanish spoken at Harrisonburg City Schools? Give up? It's Arabic. 11% of students come from Arab-speaking homes. Harrisonburg's school system is really where you see the city's status as an immigration hub come to life. More than one out of every three students are identified as limited English speakers. Within that population, kids come from 47 different countries with more than 48 languages spoken. Behind the U.S., the majority of students are born in Iraq and Honduras.
Since I was a kid, there was war there in Baghdad. It was like really big war.
This is Ali. He's 19 and from Iraq. Ali's father was granted asylum to come to the United States, but he had to leave his family behind. Ali says he was shot at when it was discovered his father had gone to the U.S. Laura Feistinger McGrath takes me into an office and flips through a stack of files of new students to the high school.
I have students who are as young as 11 and 12 who have helped their parents with mortgages. Like, I have no idea how these kids are negotiating that, which is interesting because then we throw them a multiple choice test and say that they're not successful. But the reality is they're negotiating real life, meaningful experiences.
To help refugee students integrate into the high school, a pilot program called Peer Leaders was launched last year using funding from the Harrisonburg Refugee Resettlement Office. It's a mentoring program in which new students are paired with students who were themselves refugees. Peer leaders are given 3 days of training in basic counseling, how to be an active listener, how to ask questions, and crucially, when to refer a problem to an adult.
When I came here, I was really scary. I didn't know what to do. I don't know the language. I don't know anyone.
One day, a Kurdish girl approached Ali in the hallway and asked him in Arabic if he was all right. It was a small gesture that meant a lot, to know that someone from his culture was looking out for him. He joined peer leaders so he could repeat this kindness to incoming Arab students.
There's a couple when they came here. I took them to classes. I told them some of the rules. I told them if they need help with the teacher, with the counselor, with anything, I'm here to help.
These are teenagers. It can be difficult to get them to commit to a mentorship program on top of everything else they're dealing with.
They don't know how to articulate all the time what their issues are. And then they don't always realize, adults don't always realize the extreme issues that might be happening in a high school.
It's easy to assume that the stream of refugees at Harrisonburg High is the result of the current global migration crisis. But the demographics have been like this for 15 years. The countries of strife may have changed, but the human beings seeking refuge do not. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
Those who come here seeking asylum from violence in other countries often suffer from years of poor or even non-existent medical care. In the next installment of our series on refugees in Virginia, WMRA's Jordi Yeager introduces us to one such patient and the doctors at the University of Virginia who focus on the special needs of asylum seekers.
Still, I'm alive because of the help and the generosity of the American people and the American government. Otherwise, I would have died had I not come here.
56-year-old Bimal Chetri isn't exaggerating. In all likelihood, he really would be dead if he hadn't come to Charlottesville as a refugee 2 years ago. Chetri is one of more than 3,000 refugees who've moved to Charlottesville through the International Rescue Committee since 1998. When they arrive, the IRC directs refugees to the health department, where they get rescreened and receive the vaccinations required by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They're enrolled in Medicaid and referred to UVA for their health needs.
I'm Fern Houck. I'm a physician at the University of Virginia in the Department of Family Medicine.
When Dr. Houck moved here 15 years ago, refugees had to bounce all over UVA and sometimes all over town to get the care they needed. Imagine doing that in a foreign country where you don't speak or read the language. When Dr. Houck saw this, she collaborated with the IRC and the health department and created the International Family Medicine Clinic at UVA.
Basically, we agreed that we would be the primary care physicians for all the refugees who come through the IRC into Charlottesville. The thing that's unique about our program is that we don't have a separate refugee clinic. It's incorporated into our family medicine clinic at the primary care center here.
Now, this may seem trivial, but by incorporating refugees into the everyday American experience of going to see a doctor, one significant border in a country filled with linguistic, social, and cultural barriers is crossed. The International Family Medicine Clinic has more than 2,000 refugee patients. At their initial visit, Houck and her colleagues use an in-person interpreter to explain what a family physician is. Then they try to create a medical history for the patient.
We've also worked very hard on the mental health side. We've talked about people coming from war-torn areas, being displaced from their homes, seeing people killed in front of their very eyes. Sorry.
Dr. Houck chokes up when she thinks about the trauma some of her patients have suffered. Some female refugees have been raped or been victims of genital mutilation. Others have been physically tortured. There's no easy way to raise such traumatic and horrific events, but from a medical perspective, they need to. Studies show that depression and post-traumatic stress disorder are more common among refugees than average Americans, and if left untreated, can lead to suicide. Houck's been invited to refugee weddings and adopted as an honorary family member. But perhaps the greatest joy is the prospect of seeing former patients return, not as patients, but as practitioners.
I have one who I just heard about from her mom that she just graduated this past year from dental school in Richmond. So that's pretty incredible. I want them to come back here and practice.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordi Yeager.
For refugees trying to establish themselves in a strange land, just like for the rest of us, reliable transportation can be the key to landing a job or simply being independent. One Harrisonburg bicycling enthusiast is not only teaching refugees how to ride bikes, she is also providing them with their own bicycles. WMRA's Christopher Clymer-Kurtz attended the most recent class and has this report.
The morning is not without incident. A crowd of about 10 volunteers and even more refugees from all over the world, Cuba, Pakistan, Congo, are gathered in a church parking lot to learn some tips for riding bicycle in America.
So use your back brake a little more and you'll skid rather than flipping.
There you go.
The best part? At the end of the 2 hours, the bikes they're using during the lesson will be theirs to keep. Last fall, Harrisonburg resident Richie Vaughn met with a group of women from Iraq to garner feedback about the city's bus system, sidewalks, and related infrastructure.
So just sort of offhand, I said, well, do any of you ride a bike? Because I can get across town in 20 minutes on a bike, and you're saying it takes an hour on a bus. And a bunch of them kind of like, you know, giggled and put their heads down. And it turns out that in Iraq, it's actually not socially, culturally acceptable to ride a bike if you're a woman. And several of them expressed interest in learning how to ride a bike, sort of for self-empowerment and this sort of new thing that you can do in America.
One of the 15 bicycle recipients at this recent class is Fareed Ahmed, a college computer lecturer from Karachi City in Pakistan, where he faced religious persecution. Just 2 months ago, after 3 years in Sri Lanka, he arrived in the United States. He's looking for work and says that not having a job leaves him bored at home.
Now I have bicycle, so I will use it. So it's very helpful for me to travel, especially to little nearest places.
The first part of the class is fitting helmets, here with volunteer Phoebe Kirby-Gletkowski.
Too tight now? Sorry, okay, we can make it looser.
Vaughn introduces the instructor for the day, Matt Hassman of Safe Routes to School.
Matt is going to teach us basic laws and rules here, and then we will go practice in the street with cars.
This drill will be to practice stopping quickly. Practice using both brakes so you don't go forward over the bars when you stop.
After the lesson, everyone divides into smaller language-specific clusters with an instructor and interpreter for each group, and they ride out onto the streets through a residential area of town. The bicycle Ahmed receives isn't one of the brand new ones and is without a hoped-for rack for carrying supplies. Nonetheless, he is pleased that he again has his own bicycle.
I had my bicycle in Sri Lanka, so I donate to some other refugees. They can use it. I donate there and God arranged for me here. So I am happy.
For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
And again, congratulations to Jordy and Jesse and Christopher for their fine work on that series. Of course, you can listen to all of it, find all of the pieces of that series at WMRA.org. Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Biff and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Nancy Barber, Pam and Jim Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to support our news coverage, go to WMRA.org, mouse over news, then click on News and Information Fund. All our stories are archived at that website. Be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. And don't forget to keep up each morning with the WMRA Daily, our new weekday early morning news podcast. Listen at WMRA.org and sign up for the podcast there. And tell your friends. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.